For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, back in the book of Judges tonight. It's been a pretty cool study. Do you remember last week we kicked off the book of Judges? We kind of saw the big picture, what's going on in the whole book, and looked specifically at some of the main themes of the book. And one of the things that we saw is the real lack of leadership. You know, this is a period of time before Israel had a king, after God had already brought them into the land that he had promised them. And there was no official government. There was really no one stepping up as a leader. And one of the common refrains is that there was no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so, you know, people were supposed to be under God's rulership, and having thrown that off, they just kind of went in whatever direction they wanted to, and the results were really bad, as we saw. Complete moral anarchy. We saw that this plunged them into the cycle of sin. The cycle of sin where, you know, God saves the people, they totally forget about it, they disregard him, his direction for their lives. They forget about him altogether, and what God says at that point is he takes his hands off, his protection away, and says, okay, if you don't want my protection, if you don't want me to be a part of your lives, then that's fine, and some other nation would come in and conquer them. And after some period of time of being oppressed, enslaved to another nation, the people would cry out to God, he would have pity on them and compassion on them, and he would raise up a deliverer, otherwise known as a judge, that would lead his people to freedom. And so God would save them, but then they would quickly forget about him, and the cycle would repeat itself over and over and over again. And as we read on in the book of Judges in chapter 3 that we're not going to study, we start to see this cycle, the first couple iterations of this cycle. God begins to deliver the people, and it's kind of interesting the people that he selects to deliver the Israelites. You know, the first guy, a guy named Othniel, apparently, he was in his late 80s by the time God called him to lead the people to this military victory. You know, it's kind of comical almost to think of this really old guy leading them into battle. You know, this was in an age before technological advances such as dentures and the hearing aid, fiber. I doubt the charge was really all that fast. But God used this guy. He was a feisty old man, and the Lord used him. The next guy he picks is a guy named Ehud, who was a left-handed guy. And, you know, back then there was a real stigma attached to being left-handed. And so he had that working against him, plus the fact that his name was Ehud. An unlikely deliverer. He also picked a guy named Shamgar, who was not even an Israelite. He was one of the Gentiles living in the area, and God just picked him to lead the people to victory. So, you know, the people he's using, it's like, you know, a non-Jewish person, a foreigner, a left-handed guy, and a really old guy are the three great heroes of Israel in Judges 3. And as we read on into our study tonight, that's really kind of the main subject. It's really, what kind of person does God use? Who does God use to deliver his people? And the answer is, not who you might expect. The kind of person God uses is the kind of person that believes that following God is worth taking the risk to follow him into a scary situation and to trust him to come through. So let's start reading in Judges 4. It says, after Ehud's death, the Israelites again did evil in the Lord's sight. So we see this common refrain: after the judge would die, they completely forgot about God, and they begin to rebel against him. So the Lord turned them over to King Jabin of Hazor, a Canaanite king. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. So God turns them over to the Canaanites. This was a collection of various local kings banded together for political and military strength. And the commander of their army was this guy named Sisera. Note it says that the place he lives is in Harosheth Hagoyim. That's significant because that name literally means the blacksmiths of the nations. You know, this was like 1280 BC, and so this was right before the Iron Age, and so most people didn't have iron technology. It wasn't very prevalent. But these guys did. They basically had a monopoly on iron working in that area. And so this obviously gave them a huge military advantage, you know, going up against iron chariots with, you know, swords and, with sticks and stones would have been like going against a tank with a bow and arrow or a musket. You just couldn't even compete. You didn't even try. They would sometimes do some work for the Israelites, but they wouldn't make them any dangerous weapons that they could use to defend themselves. It was usually like farm equipment and things like that. And so you see how desperate the situation was, and later in Judges 5, they write a song about all the events in chapter 4. And it talks about how bad it was. It says, people avoided the main roads, and travelers stayed on winding pathways. There were few people left in the villages of Israel. Not a shield or spear could be seen among 40,000 warriors in Israel. And so the oppression was so cruel and total that people, they wouldn't even take the main roads. They would kind of take like back alleys and cut through forests if they needed to travel from town to town because these iron chariots were roaming the plains. You know, the villages were dwindling in people. You know, they had plenty of potential warriors. The only problem was they didn't have any weapons. So you can imagine, you know, the iron chariots are coming. Yeah, go get my garden weasel so we can defend ourselves. It's, you know, it's not a battle that many Israelites were wanting to fight. And so things were looking pretty bad. These were desperate times. It says that Sisera, this is the commander of the army, who had 900 iron chariots, ruthlessly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help. And so after 20 years of oppression, they finally cry out to the Lord for help. Seems like kind of a long time to undergo ruthless oppression. But it says they finally asked God for help. And then we meet our judge, or judges, should I say. Deborah, the wife of Lapidoth, was a prophet who was judging Israel at that time. She would sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites would go to her for judgment. And so now God is using a woman, which again would have been very unexpected in a society that was totally dominated by males, for a woman to be their de facto leader, the one chosen by God. But this Deborah, man, she was obviously a really sharp girl. She was a prophetess, meaning that she would hear directly from God and could speak for God, either sometimes telling the future, sometimes just telling, you know, giving people God's interpretation of what was happening or direction from God. Also, she was a judge, so, you know, they trusted her. She had wisdom and discernment. They were bringing their disputes and their cases to her. You know, it really appears like Deborah was the only one taking any spiritual leadership at this point in Israel's history. So she is the judge. One day she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, who lived in Kadesh in the land of Naphtali. And she said to him, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Call out 10,000 warriors from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun at Mount Tabor. And I will call out Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, along with his chariots and warriors, to the Kishon River. There I will give you victory over him. And so Deborah, even though she's the judge, and usually the judge led the battle, led the war, but this time God is going to use somebody else. And that makes sense. I mean, this wasn't, women didn't go off to war. This was a guy thing. And God has told Deborah that Barak is the man that I have selected to free my people. So this sounds like a pretty good deal. You know, God lays out to Barak exactly who he should get in his army, how many he should get, where to meet the enemy, what the enemy is going to do, and he promises him God is going to provide the victory. And so here's kind of a 3D view of the land there. So you can see Mount Carmel there kind of in the center. God tells Barak, you need to go to this mountain right here, Mount Tabor. And then Sisera and his troop, they're going to gather in this plain at the foot of Mount Carmel. You know, this was the dry season. Normally there's a river that runs through there, and it can actually be kind of it's pretty good for farming because the river overflows and it makes for real fertile soil. But this was the dry season, so that riverbed was dry. And Sisera is going to mount all, is going to get all of his chariots right there. And that's where God is going to deliver the victory. Seems like a good deal. Seems like a great opportunity. Well, Barak disagreed. He says, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. So he's got the nerve to directly disobey a command of God. Deborah says, go. Barak says, no. And he kind of negotiates with God. Here are my terms. Here are the terms on which I'll go into battle and do this thing you called me to do, God. So, it kind of raises the question, why did Barak refuse to go alone? You know, certainly, I'm sure it wasn't because Deborah was physically stronger than him. Maybe she was like one of those Amazon women on American Gladiators. But I think the text probably would have mentioned something like that, that superhuman strength, freakish biceps. It's not because he was too busy, you know. He actually does go into battle with her once she agrees to go with him. So it's not a case where he just doesn't want any part of this. It doesn't say exactly, but I think one thing's pretty clear. This is a huge risk that God is calling on him to take. I mean, he mentioned the chariots specifically. God says all the chariots are going to be there. These guys had been whooping Israel for the last 20 years. It was pretty well established that they could not defeat this foe. And God is calling him to take a huge risk. And that's scary. That's real scary. And let's talk a little bit about taking risks for God. See, the reality is that if you want to follow God, you're going to have to take some risks. In fact, following God is all about taking risks. And, you know, God is not going to call us to do something like this. He's not going to, probably not going to call us to some kind of military battle on his behalf. But he does call us to other things. And there might be a risk that God is calling on you to take in your life right now. You know, maybe there's a leadership opportunity that's pretty scary, that God has obviously cleared everything out of the way, and he said, this is what I want you to do. Whether that's a larger group, a smaller group, even just taking a servant leadership role in someone else's life. That might be something God is calling on you to do, and that's scary to put yourself out there like that. You know, maybe it's building a relationship. This can be risky. It's vulnerable. You risk rejection. It's hard work. You realize there might be some things I won't be able to do if I really try to actually love this person, if I let this person into my life, or if I pursue them and try and get into their life. Maybe there's a conversation God wants you to have. And that can be a variety of things. Maybe it's a tough conversation with, maybe you need to speak some truth into someone's life to say, I see a problem here, and I've been sitting on it for a while, kind of afraid to say anything, but I realize I just can't let this go any longer. Maybe it's a conversation about God with one of your friends or a family member that doesn't know God, and God is calling on you to speak up and to say something. Maybe it's a conversation where you say, hey, there's something I need to confess to you, and it's something I've been sitting on for a long time, and maybe God is calling on you to finally take that terrifying step of opening your mouth and confessing, saying what happened. Maybe it's just getting serious about spiritual growth. You realize there's risks involved. There's, I don't know where this could lead. You know, you start saying yes to God, and you never know what's going to happen. All of a sudden, you're on top of Mount Tabor with 10,000 Israelites. It's scary. And, you know, I'm not talking about just randomly taking risks for God here. You know, there's stupid risks. But then there's risks that God actually calls on you to do. And this was something that God had specifically told him. I want you to do this. And even though following God is all about taking risks, you know, our natural response is to avoid these risks. We really, we're usually creatures of comfort. We don't want to put ourselves out there in a way where we might be out of control, where we might be harmed in some way. We kind of have a fear of the unknown. So what was Barak doing here? He's probably using some sort of strategy. And we have strategies, too, to get around taking risks for God. You know, for one, he might have been calling her bluff. Maybe he's thinking, Well, if I tell her, why don't you go with me? Then she'll be like, I'm not going into that. And then we'll be at a stalemate and nobody will have to do anything. And, you know, this would stem from you a warped view of spiritual leadership. I think there's this view that once you're at a certain level, like then you've arrived and you don't take any more risks or do anything else scary for God. Or it's like, you know, you work hard just to work your way up the ladder and then everybody else has to do all the grunt work, all the dangerous work. And maybe Barak had this view of leadership. I know this is certainly the world's view of leadership. It's definitely not the way God sees things. I mean, Jesus says, you know, you sure you want to lead like me? Well, you better be ready to suffer like me. He says, no servant is above his master. I suffered, they persecuted me. Eventually they killed him. And he says, you're going to be in for the same. And so if you want to lead for God, you got to understand that, you know, there's going to be some risks involved. And anything you're calling on other people to do is something that you better be willing to do yourself. And so, you know, maybe he was calling her bluff. Unfortunately, that didn't work because she agrees to go with him. Maybe he realized, and this is very realistic, that this was just beyond his capabilities. You know, he's thinking to himself, there's no way I can defeat the mighty Sisera and his 900 chariots and his vast, you know, horde of armed forces with my army of sticks and stones. There's just no way I can stand against that. And the truth is that he was right. But the problem is that there's a misunderstanding here. And that he's ignoring God's power in this entire situation. If you ever want to do anything courageous or bold for God, you've got to have a very clear perspective. You've got to see how powerful God truly is. And that when God sends you into battle, you're really not relying on your resources. Okay? I mean, sure, Barak had an important role here. We're not going to minimize or be super spiritual or just be like, well, it doesn't matter what we do. God doesn't need us at all. No, that's not true. God has always worked through human leaders to accomplish his role, to accomplish his purpose. We do need people who are willing to step out and lead for God, step out and take chances for him. But at the same time, to think that I have to be able to do it all on my own, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, God wants to do something supernatural through you, not something natural. He wants to do great things, not the kind of things that you're capable of. And so we've got to have a clear view of God's power. And, you know, there's a few common forms of this, the way that we slip into this trap. You know, one is the comparison evasion, I guess, where we say, well, I'm not as blank as him or her, God. You couldn't possibly want me to do this. You must mean that person over there. And you can plug in whatever you want there in the blank. I'm not as smart. I'm not as fun. I'm not as stable. I'm not as mature. I'm not as old. I'm not as young. I'm not as well-spoken. I'm not as reflective. There's always something that you're not as good at as somebody else's. A lot of things. And so we try and evade through using these comparisons and get out of actually acting. Well, another one is the false humility approach, where we say, I've just got far too many problems. I mean, look at me. I'm blank, God. And you can really plug a lot of those same things in that you did in the first blank. You know, I'm not smart enough. I'm not spiritual enough. I'm not tall enough. You know, whatever. We come up with really weird ideas as to why we can't act for God. And I call this one the false humility because the way it sounds from God, it kind of sounds like humility at first, like, oh, there's no way I could do that. But the reality is that from God's perspective, it's incredibly arrogant. Because here's basically the translation. I've translated this for us. I speak false humility. You're saying, hi, Creator God of the universe. I'd like to assert that I know myself better than you know me, and I understand the task you want me to attempt far better than you understand it. After much thought, I've decided that it's simply not going to work, even if this is your will, and you've promised to put all of your power at my disposal. False humility. If you ignore God's power, you're never going to be able to do anything significant. You'll never be able to do anything unless you're absolutely certain ahead of time that you can do it on your own. And that's just a bad way to live your life. That's a boring way to live your life. If you live your life that way, you're going to be really disappointed at the outcome. You're going to get into this rut where everything's predictable, everything's under your control. You get in that for a while, it's hard to even figure out how to get out of that. So Barak, he probably realized this was beyond his capabilities. And that may have been part of his evasion here. Here's one that I think is pretty probable. I think he saw that Deborah was the more experienced leader. I mean, think about it. Everybody knew Deborah. Everybody would come out to the palm tree to get judged by her. They respected her. She was obviously the prophetess. She was the judge. She was the one God was using. She had the name recognition. It was her idea anyway. It's easy to think, well, how about Deborah leads and I just be her helper? How about I just be Deborah's assistant if we go into battle this way? And the problem here is making someone else take ultimate responsibility. You know, this does seem attractive. You know, if Barak can just kind of hang out in the background, defer to her, let her really be the leader, he's like, yeah, you know, I'll play a role, I guess. But as far as stepping out on my own without this security blanket right here, that's just not something I'm prepared to do. And we can kind of protect ourselves from failure this way. You know, there's safety in hiding behind somebody else. There's safety in never really extending yourself. You know, you can continue to kind of, you know, do a bunch of nice things and never really do anything wrong, but are you really willing to step out and lead for God? Are you really willing to risk failing and looking like a complete idiot? Are you really willing to leave the nest, to leave mommy and daddy behind, and to go out and do the thing God wants you to do? You know, I've struggled with this. You know, I remember early on my attempts to lead for God, to serve Him. You know, I'd be like talking to somebody and I'd see an issue in their life and I'd be like, well, I think this is really a problem and this other guy agrees with me. We all think this is a problem. It was almost like I couldn't just have a conversation. I had to really kind of blame the other person for the thing I was bringing up. Or, you know, it's like a big decision would come up and I'd immediately be picking up the phone, trying to call somebody else, trying to get them to make this decision for me. I'd want to go and say something or even have a conversation with somebody. And before I'd even do it, I'd be like checking with other people for permission to have this talk. And the whole thing, it's almost like I couldn't even think for myself. I'd be talking to somebody and I wouldn't even be able to focus that much on the conversation because I'd be thinking one thing, but then checking what would this other person say. And it's kind of a weird relationship. It seems kind of humble at first. You know, it's obviously I'm not calling for autonomy or anything like that. It's not wrong to seek counsel, but if we're afraid to ever leave the nest and to step out on our own, to share our own convictions with people, especially when God is calling us to step out, I think that's a problem. I mean, this parent-child relationship, that's necessary for kids for a little while. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid, you can't fend for yourself. You can't think for yourself. But there comes a point where you got to move out. You got to grow up and become a spiritual adult who's not always checking with mom and dad, who's not thinking, ooh, I wonder what dad's going to do when he gets home. But where you actually turn to God and ask God, how do I deal with this? How can I be a spiritual, responsible adult in this situation and take the leadership, take the risk that I know you want me to take, God? It's scary. I know it is, especially when that person has always been there. They've always been looking out for you. They pick up the slack when you falter. They're praying for you. They're always thinking a couple steps ahead. But you're never going to get to that point unless you're willing to do what Barak was unwilling to do and to take the risky step of faith that God is calling on you to take. We can't just shift responsibility for our life to somebody else, spiritual or otherwise. You got to take responsibility for your own life. One more I think we see a risk evasion tactic is this victim mentality. And that's where we say that I can't do this because there's something beyond my control that is keeping me from doing whatever God is calling me to do. Sometimes it's external circumstances. We say, well, my job just sucks, and there's nothing I can do about it. Or my advisor said no. You know, my advisor was pretty firm about the whole thing. My parents have been really giving me a hard time lately. Well, I'm just really busy. You know, it's like I'm swept up in this life that's just beyond my control, and there's nothing I can do about it. I've never really been mentored, or if I was, it wasn't very good, and I just kind of got screwed, and therefore I'm just handicapped for the rest of my life. There's also the win-then game. This is similar to the first one, but it's like, well, when I feel confident, then I'll step out and, you know, try and serve. Or when I get a grip on my problems, that's the point where I'm going to start focusing on other people. Until then, though, I've got so many problems. I just can't do it until then. When I'm finally done with school, that's when I'll, you fill in the blank. That's when I'll start obeying God. And, you know, throughout all these, you know, this victim mentality, people with a victim mentality can be pretty dangerous people because they feel totally justified in whatever they're doing. And any constraint they might have is canceled out by this thought, well, I can't help it because of this. It's like they give up taking responsibility for their actions. And, you know, I'm not sure which of these reasons Barak was thinking when he tried to avoid this risk, but I think we can relate to all of this. And let's see how Deborah responds to this, how God responds to this. She says, very well, I will go with you. But you will receive no honor in this venture, for the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh. So he calls her bluff, and she wasn't bluffing. She says, I will go with you. But what's happened here is you've lost an opportunity. An opportunity for some really cool things. And we need to stop viewing risks as things to be avoided at all costs or circumvented in some way. We need to start viewing them as opportunities. Godly risk is an opportunity for a number of things. You know, for one, it's an opportunity to see God do something great, to see the power of God unleashed through you. I mean, have you ever been there when somebody has become a Christian? You know, to see the tears rolling down their face as they realize the grace of God for the first time ever? Have you seen someone's life transformed to where before they were such a basket case, so many problems, lonely, depressed, suicidal, to see them become a joyful, relational person, serving person, giving person? It's one of the greatest things you can possibly do with your life. It's one of the greatest things you can see. And you know that it wasn't me that did this. You know, you basically just followed God where he led, and somehow he used you to have an impact on this other person. It's incredible. You know, contrast that with Barak here, where he had an opportunity to do something great, and he gets to do something good, but it's not quite what it could have been. There's an opportunity to grow in your faith. You know, there's nothing like being extended beyond your comfort zone to where you're terrified. Realizing, boy, I don't have the strength to pull this off. It's going to have to be God and God alone that pulls me through this. And that's where your faith grows. I mean, contrast that with Barak, where, you know, his faith may have grown some, maybe none at all, who knows? But your faith can't grow unless you allow God to stretch you beyond where you actually trust him. And then you have this crisis, this wrestling. And then finally, you see God come through, and you see how silly it was to doubt God, and your faith gets a little bigger, a little stronger. It's an opportunity for rewards and honor. You know, it's cool to be used by God. I mean, God promises that as Christian believers, if we follow God, all of our service that we offer up on his behalf, he promises to reward us for that someday when we get to heaven. That's something that we are guaranteed from Jesus Christ himself. You know, contrast that with Barak, where she's like, you know, you could have had some really cool honor through this, but that honor is just going to go to somebody else. I'm going to deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman, not you. There's also the satisfaction of knowing that you did what God asked. This is pretty cool. You know, this is where you know that God called me to do something, and I did it. And, you know, maybe I didn't want to do it at first, but I eventually stepped out, and I saw him come through. It's a cool feeling. You know, contrast this with probably the embarrassment of Barak. You know, all of Israel knew that he was the guy that this task had been carved out for. God had called him to do this, and he chickened out. I mean, imagine the scene where, you know, Deborah's husband is kissing her goodbye as she goes off to war. And he stands there with the children and all the other women and children. And he's just giving Barak the look. You know, the look that says, dude, seriously? I'm stuck at home here while you go to war with my wife because you're too afraid to go by yourself? You know, people knew that this was Barak's role. And he didn't fully step into that like God wanted him to. And it's weird because, you know, I mean, in my job, I kind of get little windows into various churches and I see what's going on there. And it's funny because there's certain situations where you just see that there's like a need and God has clearly placed a person there and he wants them to meet that need, to step into that role. And they don't want to do it. They're too afraid to do it. And it's frustrating because you can see how great they would be if they would just step out. And you know, other people in their church can even see this. Spiritual people can see what's going on. And it's hard to see, you know, people just have to wait around until either that person steps forward or God raises somebody else up to do it. And finally, it's an opportunity for deeper intimacy with God. It drives you to your knees in prayer. It makes you all the more attentive to hear the voice of God when you're scared out of your mind. It's interesting because later in this narrative, Deborah does go with him. And it finally comes a point where she's like, okay, Barak, now's the time to go. God has given them into your hand. You know, she signals the charge. And, you know, what if Deborah hadn't gone? How would Barak have known that this was time to go? Well, God would have told him directly. But he kind of missed an opportunity there. I mean, missed an opportunity to get a little bit closer to God, to be a little more acquainted with God's voice, to see him just throw himself into dependence, into the arms of the God of the universe. And so it's an opportunity for all of these things. It's something we should really consider taking God up on when he puts these risks in our paths. And the antithesis, the opposite, is real bad. If you want to live your life avoiding taking chances, saying no to the opportunities God puts in front of you, it's going to lead to a very bad place pretty quickly. I like how this one author puts it. He says, where does risk avoidance lead? Well, it leads to sinful patterns of behavior that never get confronted and changed. It leads to abilities and gifts that never get cultivated and deployed. Until weeks become months and months become years. And one day you're looking back on a life of deep, intimate, gut-wrenchingly honest conversations that you never had. And great, bold prayers that you just never prayed. Exhilarating risks that you never took. Sacrificial gifts you never offered. Lives that you never touched. And you're sitting in a recliner with a shriveled soul and forgotten dreams. And you realize there was a world of desperate need. And a great God calling you to be part of something bigger than yourself. You see the person you could have become but did not. Because you never followed your calling. You never got out of the boat. Do you want to be the kind of person that sits there and watches other people do great things for God? Or do you want to experience the thrill of the battle, the changed lives, the fulfilled dreams that come from following him? Because the price of that, it's going to be some fear, some risks, as you follow God into the unknown and watch his power unleashed before your very eyes. Well, at Kadesh, called together the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali, and 10,000 warriors went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. So 10,000 dudes and Deborah on this mountain. Now, Heber the Kenite, a descendant of Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, had moved away from the other members of his tribe and pitched his tent by the oak of Zanaim near Kadesh. So this was like a distant relative of Moses was living not too far from there. This becomes significant later in the story. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, he called for all 900 of his iron chariots and all of his warriors, and they marched from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River. And so, it may have even been Heber the Kenite that informed Sisera of this giant movement of troops. So he kind of was like a neutral party informing Sisera. He pulls out the big guns. He gets all of his artillery together and all of his warriors, and they march and they line up in the valley right between that Mount Carmel range and Mount Tabor where the Israelites were stationed. And maybe he was thinking, well, we'll just wait them out because they got to come down from the mountain sometime and they're no match for us on the plains, even if our chariots can't go up the mountain. So they kind of have them treed. Well, Deborah said to Barak, get ready. This is the day the Lord will give you victory over Sisera, for the Lord is marching ahead of you. And she sends them into battle, rushing down the mountain. Barak led his 10,000 warriors down the slopes of Mount Tabor into battle. And we read in Judges chapter 5 the poetic account of what happened next. They say the stars fought from heaven. The stars in their orbits fought against Sisera. The Kishon River swept them away, the ancient torrent, the Kishon. Then the horse's hooves hammered the ground and the galloping of Sisera's mighty steeds. So apparently what happened was Barak and his troops charged into battle, and that's the moment where God sprang into action. And you can imagine being Sisera's army, seeing the Israelites charging down the mountain towards you, and then looking off to the right and seeing a huge wall of water, a flash flood from a freak rainstorm during the dry season coming around the corner right into the riverbed where all your troops are arrayed. Obviously, that water would have rendered the chariots pretty useless. Chariots don't do too well in several feet of water that's with mud underneath of it. And so the army was thrown into a panic. The horses start freaking out. Apparently, they begin like trampling some of the other soldiers in the army. And at that point, it's every man for himself. It says, when Barak attacked, the Lord threw Sisera and all his chariots and warriors into a panic. Sisera leaped down from his chariot and escaped on foot, probably because the chariot wouldn't move anymore. So Sisera runs away. Barak chased all the chariots and the enemy army all the way to Harosheth Hagoyim, killing all Sisera's warriors. Not a single one was left alive. So the ragtag Israelite army, with their sticks and stones, defeated the mighty, well-armed Canaanite army. Meanwhile, though, Sisera ran to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because Heber's family was on friendly terms with the king Haban of Jazer. Remember, they were camped out in Canaanite land, not too far away. He knew they were allies. They had probably informed him in the first place of this movement. And so he goes to Heber, and he runs to the tent of Jael, who was a woman living there. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, come into my tent, sir, come in, don't be afraid. Which he should have known something was up at that point. So he went into her tent, and she covered him with a blanket. Please give me some water, he said, I'm thirsty. So she gave him some milk from a leather bag and covered him up again. I know on a hot summer day in the dry desert, there's nothing more refreshing than nice, hot, curdled milk from a goat's bladder. So he's hiding in her tent under the blanket. He's thirsty. She slips him some milk under the blanket. And then he says, stand at the door of the tent. If anybody comes in and asks you if there's anyone here, say no. So just like Barak had an opportunity to be used by God, now Jael has an opportunity. Sisera is sleepy. He's racked out from that milk that she gave him, nice warm milk. And, you know, what's she going to do in this situation? You know, she's got Hitler in her tent after being routed by the Allies. She can do anything she wants to this guy. Is she going to pull a Barak here? Is she going to play it safe? Let somebody else take responsibility for this? Is she going to run and get her daddy and get dad to do something about this? Or is she going to take a risk? Is she going to step forward and allow herself to be used by God? Well, it says, when Sisera fell asleep from exhaustion, Jael quietly crept up to him with a hammer and a tent peg in her hand. I think you see where this is going. The women in this nomadic culture, they would move around a lot, and the women were responsible for putting up the tents every time they moved. So, you know, she'd been driving wooden pegs into the ground for her entire life. So Jael, you know, she quietly creeps up to Sisera, heart pounding inside of her chest. You know, she's thinking to herself, all right, Jael, get one shot at this. You better make it good. And then, boom, she drove the tent peg through his temple and into the ground. And so he died. Nice shot. That's brutal. Well, when Barak came looking for Sisera, Jael went out to meet him. Watch out, Barak. She said, come and I'll show you the man you're looking for. So he followed her into the tent and found Sisera lying there dead with the tent peg through his temple. She's like, that's how you do it right there, buddy. Well, so on that day, Israel saw God defeat Jabin, the Canaanite king. And from that time on, Israel became stronger and stronger against King Jabin until they finally destroyed him. And so once again, God delivers his people. You know, the question here was never, is God going to come through? The question is, how is God going to come through? Who's he going to use? And he offered that opportunity to one guy, and he just felt like the risk was too great. And so he offered it to the most unlikely candidate, this woman named Jael. And I'd like to just spend just a few minutes contrasting these two characters that were left at the end of our story, standing in the tent over Sisera's body. On the one hand, Barak, well, he was qualified to deliver Israel, no doubt about it. He had an impressive resume. The military leader, he was a male. He was a pure blood Israelite, publicly chosen by the woman that everybody knew was speaking for God. Jael, on the other hand, possessed no qualifications to deliver Israel at all. She was a housewife, a domestic laborer. She was good at setting up tents and cooking. She was female. And again, in this male-dominated society, nobody would have picked a female to defeat the most powerful commander in the entire area. She was a foreigner, not even in Israel, and she was an informant. His family had a treaty with the enemy. Barak had direct instructions and promises from God. God had said, here's exactly what you do. I'm going to come through. He had a 100% guarantee from Yahweh himself, Jael. No instructions, no promises from God. She just had Sisera stumble into her tent one day and had to do something about it. Barak, he put conditions on God to avoid risk. God gave him a command, and Barak offered a counteroffer, a proposal. He started the negotiations. Whereas Jael, she acted boldly and without hesitation, very boldly. Barak tried to minimize responsibility. He tried to get somebody else to take responsibility for this whole thing. Whereas Jael, she took full responsibility. She didn't call mommy or daddy. She stepped up into the opportunity God had given her. And finally, Barak, he should have been the hero. He should have been the one to deliver Israel. But Jael was the unexpected deliverer of Israel. And you know, this is really, this is how God works. God is not a God that picks the people that, from a human perspective, seem most likely, most qualified, most able, or competent. God picks the nobodies of this world. In fact, these are God's terms for salvation. If we come to God as just competent, feeling like our own good deeds can get us into heaven, God's going to say, I can't deal with somebody that has an attitude like that. But if we come to God admitting how weak we are, how selfish we are, how far short we fall of his standard, and how little we deserve his grace or mercy, God says, that's the kind of attitude I want. And he's making that grace and love and mercy available to anyone who's willing to turn to him and ask him to freely give it to them. I like how 1 Corinthians 1 says it. He says, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one who may boast before him. Therefore, as it is written, let those who boast, boast in the Lord. That's the kind of God we're dealing with, and that's the kind of offer that he makes to you. So there you got the story of Barak, Deborah, and Jael. All right, why don't we pray? God, thank you that you're a God we can trust, that you're a God that's worth following. Thanks that when you tell us to go, Lord, you go with us, you go ahead of us, and that we get the privilege of being used by you to do things that we could never do on our own. Thanks that following you is going to lead to the best, most fulfilling life, the life we always wanted deep down, Lord. Thank you that you know our dreams. You know the desires of our hearts. And you want us to live a fulfilled, incredible life. I pray, too, if there's anybody here that doesn't know you, that they would turn and they would experience a personal relationship with you, Lord, that they would invite you into their lives. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.